Think of one of the most, or maybe the most important promise that you've ever made. Or maybe think about one of the most important promises ever made to you. I think those of us who are married would call to mind our wedding day and the vows that we make to our spouse, to love, to hold, to cherish, to never depart from them in sickness or in health. Some of us, hopefully, think about our baptism and either the promises that were made on our behalf if we were baptized as infants, or the promises that we made ourselves if we were baptized later in life. This Lent, we're going to be exploring the different promises that God has made to his people throughout his history with them. If you think about why promises are important, they're important for a lot of reasons, but think emotionally. Think about your marriage if you're married. When your marriage undergoes stress, it's strained by external pressures or by our own faulty wiring. What you rely on oftentimes is the strength of the covenant you made to your spouse. It's like a lifeline that steers you through challenging times. God is a covenant maker. A covenant is simply an agreement that two parties go into in which they vow to either perform or refrain from certain activities. It's a binding agreement. It's not a contract. It's not simply a handshake. There's something very profound and basic about a covenant. Our God is a covenant maker. And one way to organize God's history with his people is to think about the covenants he makes as chapters in a unified story. God makes a covenant with Adam, and it doesn't go very well on Adam's end. Then God makes a covenant with Noah and all creation. Then God chooses one man, Abraham, makes a covenant with him, and births a nation. Then God makes a covenant with Moses. Then God makes a covenant with David. And then finally, to the church, God makes a new covenant. Covenant is one way to structure the whole history of God's life with his people. And this idea of God promising to do certain things, it not only structures the biblical story, but it helps frame, I think, the basic existential question the Bible provokes. The question that we're all asking, though we use very different words, but the question we're all asking, right, is blessing from God? Are the good things from God? Is God's promise of a new life, is that something I have to earn? Or is that something that God freely bestows? Is grace, favor, goodness from the Lord, is that something God's holding over me as a payment? Or is that a gift that God freely gives? The reason why we're exploring covenants, the idea of covenant during Lent, is because, well, like we just prayed, Lent is all about acknowledging. It's a season to trudge down beneath the ground floor into the basements of our lives, our hearts. And it's a season to acknowledge that there's some monsters down there. There's patterns of brokenness that generate a whole host of sinful behaviors. And that can be very morbid. That can be very unhealthy, that kind of interiority. But covenants, saturating our minds around the covenants, our prayer, is that it would give us courage to do that necessary soul work that Lent invites us into. But it would do it in such a way that, we wouldn't break, we wouldn't fracture. Like a marriage, undergoing difficult times, you rely on the promise that your spouse makes to you in the form of a covenant to see you through. Well, if we saturate our minds and our hearts around the idea of God's covenants with us, God's promises to us. Maybe it will encourage us. It will give us the courage that we need to have a good Lent. So the sermon for today is about Noah. It's about the covenant God makes with Noah. I'm sure many of us are familiar with the broad outlines of this story, right? You have the flood, the ark, the animals, the dove. Some of us know it better than others. It's good news. It's going to be a very simple message today. We're not going to talk about Noah. We're not going to talk about the ark. We're not talking about the animals. We're going to talk about the central character in the story, and that is God. And what I think is the central tension in this story, not will humanity survive, not how many animals were really in the ark, not did the flood really happen. I think the central question that this story is asking is, how does God respond to sin? How does God respond to sin? And not just what does God do in response to sin, though that's certainly a question the text is answering, but what this story, you know, it's four chapters in Genesis, what this story gives us, it paints this incredible picture about what goes on inside God's heart when he sees creation ravaging itself through sin. So what does God, how does God feel about sin, our sin, sin of the world, and what does God do about it? 2 points. God grieves because of our sin. It pains him. And sin, though monstrous, is perhaps is an occasion for God's grace. Sin grieves God, and sin is an occasion for grace. First grief. If you were to ask a man on the street, why did God send the flood? You know, that story is familiar enough that it has a lot of purchase on people's imagination, even if they're not familiar with the Bible. Why did God send the flood? I would think that you'd hear words like, he was angry, or he was mad, he was furious. It's an expression of wrath, you know, the God of the Old Testament. Scary. And then maybe there's some elements of truth to that, but if you read the four chapters, Genesis 6, Genesis 7, Genesis 8, and Genesis 9, cover this story, you will never, not once, see the word anger or the word fury or the word wrath. What you'll see is grief and sadness and pain. Here's what I mean. Find my notes. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness had become, and the Lord was grieved that he had made the man on the earth. His heart was filled with pain. How does God respond to sin? What does God think about sin? Sin fills his heart with pain. Now, in Hebrew, that word, filled with pain, that's just a single word. And it's used to describe the most intense kind of emotion. It's anguish. You know, there's rage part of it, but it's anguish. So, for example, later in Genesis, when a few brothers find out that their sister had been raped, it says their hearts were filled with pain. Same word. Later in the Old Testament, a son finds out that his father is planning to kill his son's best friend. Fills his heart with pain. I think many of us know experientially what that word entails. And think of your relationships with your kids. I caused a fair share of trouble for my parents, and I know a lot of parents who are raising troublesome kids. You know, kids who are living their lives in such a way that's destructive and that goes against everything their parents so diligently tried to impress upon them. And what you see in those situations, you know, wayward teenagers or whatever, I mean, there's a lot of anger, there's tirades, but what you really see are the tears, the pain, the heartbreak of watching your kids, you know, ruin themselves. So, the world, in Genesis 6 is not going God's way. He created man and woman as the pinnacle of his creation. And their task was to steward God's good earth, God's creation. And now he's up, you know, he's watching the stewards of his creation preside over its destruction. So he does respond in judgment. And we can't escape the simple fact that this story does teach that sin does provoke in the heart of God judgment. But what I'm trying to say is that we cannot separate God's love, God's care, God's concern from God's judgment. In fact, what I'm really trying to say is that the reason why God is in pain, the reason why sin grieves God so much, is because God, who is purely love, has willed to love even the objects of his judgment. You know, when we talk about God being in pain, God grieving, it's not like when we get frustrated and our love turns sour. God is holy, and his love is pure, and judgment is his unwillingness to be passive in the face of corruption. So this flood story does teach us that sin provokes judgment, but what it teaches us more than anything else is that God is committed to love us, and even when he has to punish us, even when God does judge sin, it's an expression of his love, his unwillingness to be passive in the face of corruption. Now, how helpful is it here at the outset of Lent to be reminded that sin is serious? And not serious because God is incensed when we break the rules. You know, that's not my point. But sin is completely destructive. It unmakes creation. It disfigures us and makes us less human. And it grieves the Lord. It fills the Lord with pain. That's what our sin does. You know, there's a reason why a storybook Bible doesn't include pictures of dead animals and bloated people floating atop the floodwaters. You know, sin is really deadly. It kills. And it can't be waved away. It can't be simply washed away. It's serious. It provokes judgment, and it grieves the Lord. But second point, sin is also an occasion for grace. It's an occasion for grace. Now, I said earlier that God is really the main character in this story. And you see that through a couple things, you know, when you read the story in its entirety. For example, Noah never speaks at all throughout the whole ordeal of the flood. Never says a word. The only time he talks is at the very end of the story. And if you know the story, it's not a very good moment for Noah and his sons. He never speaks. But God, throughout those four chapters of Genesis, is speaking all the time. The narrator of Genesis never gives us any insight, not even a hint, about what Noah and his family were thinking when they received this bizarre challenge to build an ark. It never tells us, it never gives us a glimpse of Noah's inner life. But the narrator discloses very openly, you know, God's feelings, what's going on inside God's heart. Why is that? Well, it's because something remarkable happens in this story, and I think it's easy to miss it. It's maybe even more remarkable than the idea that sin grieves the Lord. And it's deceptively simple, but here it is. God changes direction in this story. This story really is, it represents a pretty radical turn in God's history with his people. Here's what I mean. You know, we heard that the essence of the covenant with Noah, God's covenant with creation, is that he would never destroy the earth with a flood again. And what it represents, what the covenant with Noah really represents in terms of its biblical significance, is this idea that God will remain engaged with creation despite its sin. that God will not restart with a clean slate. God covenants to patiently endure his people's unfaithfulness in order to redeem them. It's a good promise. But we like to think sometimes that the flood worked, right? There was a poison that necessitated the flood, and God promised to never send the flood again because it was cleansed. But the flood didn't work in that sense. The flood didn't wash away what caused it. And God admits as much in the story. It's after Noah comes out of the ark, the floodwaters recede. Noah builds an altar to the Lord. He makes a sacrifice. And then we read this. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood." I want you to hold that "even though" phrase in your mind and compare it with the reason we're given for the flood in the first place. This is from Genesis 6. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was evil all the time. So the Lord said, "I will wipe mankind, whom I have created, from the face of the earth, men and animals, creatures that move along the ground, and the birds of the air." So do you see the paradox here? God flooded the earth because the inclination of the human heart was evil. Post-flood, God says, "I will never do this again," even though the inclination of the human heart remains evil. So what was the flood? Ooh, that didn't work? Sorry? You know, well, the flood, it did slow down Earth's corruption. God did put in place safeguards to preserve creation, to like retard its degeneration. But the cycle of violence and evil would continue on. Why? Because the terror, just the basic divide that we all know, the divide that leaves us susceptible to do terrible things, to not just occasionally choose what's wrong, but whatever it is inside the human heart that predisposes us to do wrong, to curve in on ourselves and resist the instruction of the Lord. That's every one of our hearts. We're born with that. And what this text is saying is that the flood, it didn't change that. It didn't change that. So then what does the flood represent? The flood and this whole saga represents a turn. A turn. And it represents grace. Because what we see, this is early on in the Bible. This is like 4 pages in. But we had this basic problem, right? How will God judge sin? Like I said, he has to. He's holy. He can't stand by in the face of corruption and just do nothing. It would not be just if wickedness and injustice and evil went unpunished or was allowed to thrive. God just can't do that. But if God were to judge humankind, we would all be wiped out. We would be destroyed. So there's this basic problem. How can God be faithful to his own character and we not be destroyed in the process? How can God judge sin and not destroy the sinner? That's the basic problem that this text is screaming, and like a bright red arrow, it is pointing, brothers and sisters, to the cross of Jesus Christ. Because there, God himself assumes the justice which sin provokes. You know, what's the line from the hymn? That's where God's sorrow, God's grief, God's pain, God's judgment against sin meets with grace. You know, sorrow and love flow mingled down. That's the line from the hymn. Grief and grace, they come together. And so we can say, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. The flood is the story is a glimmer of that glorious truth from the beginning of the Bible. Okay, one last point. The rainbow. I read a story earlier this week about a couple who does ministry in the inner city, in an urban area in Trenton, New Jersey, actually. And they were sharing the story of Noah and the Ark to a bunch of young kids, and they asked, you know, a very children's sermon-like question, where do you guys see rainbows? And the kids replied uniformly, oh, we see rainbows in the street. And they thought, huh, I guess they misunderstood the question. Where do you see rainbows? Oh, yeah, we see them in the street. And then what they realized, that these kids raised exclusively in this very urban, concrete jungle context, the places that they see the rainbow, where they see rainbows is in potholes in their neighborhoods. Potholes that get filled with water, and then potholes that become slick and greasy when cars with leaky engines drips in and gets slick. Can you guys picture that in your mind's eye? That's where these kids saw rainbows. And at first, the couple was kind of dismayed about that. Maybe that's a cause for charity. And maybe it is. But if you think about it, it's actually a very profound and heartening signal about where we find the grace of God in our lives. You know, what better place to find testimonies to God's faithfulness than the places where we actually live, right? I mean, it's one thing to have to drive 8 hours to Denver to see a rainbow, but that's not how the grace of God works. The grace of God isn't about transferring you to realms of beauty and of an ineffable glory that you can never glimpse otherwise. The grace of God is about getting into the dirty puddles of your own life. You know, like I said earlier, it's in the basements. That's where the rainbows really are. It's where God is working in the main and plain and grittiness of daily life. That's where the rainbows are. And so this Lent, that's why I want to encourage you guys, this Lent, to take courage, to not be afraid to look in the puddles, in the greasy, grimy potholes. Because it could be that is where God has placed a rainbow. That is where you'll find a sign of faithfulness, commitment, a covenant of grace. Amen? Amen.